This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
Walking each other home is an exploration of the many ways we cultivate wisdom, compassion, and love in our lives. Mirabai Bush talks with some of her many diverse friends about what they're learning now from their spiritual paths and practices. If you would like to support this podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Mirabai.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Mirabai Bush, and this is Walking Each Other Home. And we'd like to do that together with you for the next hour or so. This series brings together a number of diverse people who are all talking about ways in which they are waking up and coming into spiritual deepening, and how we share that with and help each other along the path. We can't do this alone, and we can really help each other. And not always by, being physically with each other or calling each other on the phone, but simply being in each other's lives and doing the work that we do with integrity. So that's what unifies the many people who've come together so far. And today we have a wonderful guest, Iris Brilliant. And I've known Iris since she was born, which is a real honor. And now she's one of the people who I think knows the most about the working with your resources, your wealth, in alignment with your values. And of course, Ram Dass's teaching all has to do with discovering your values and then cultivating them and living your life in that way. So, and not so many people have, focused on money and wealth and possessions and the inequity of wealth in this society in relation to what's important to each one of us. And I really feel like Iris has done an amazing job, isn't the word, but she has an amazing understanding of how that all works. And I wanted to hear more, and I think it'll be great. Even if you don't have a lot of money or don't think you have a lot of money, we all have to deal with money all the time. And we all have resources other than money as well that we need to appreciate and value so that we can use them in the way that's best for us and for everyone. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And so let's see. Iris, why don't you tell us a few lines of your biography in terms of how you got to where we are now? You know, it doesn't have to be the traditional stuff, but what brought you to where we are now, where you are now?
Thank you so much for having me. I've been really excited to get to do this together. A bit about my money journey in particular. So I was raised wealthy. I grew up with class privilege without really being aware of it because of the lack of dialogue and transparency about money in class, and also because of class segregation, right? I grew up with predominantly wealthy, if not wealthier people, and felt very confused about class and money, and just grew up with the sense that it wasn't something we could discuss, but it was something that we should feel some degree of shame or privacy around. I got deeply politicized in college, as many of us do, around racial justice organizing, feminist and queer organizing, and got trained as an organizer, became an anti-capitalist, and also began a pretty strong Dharma practice as well. I went on my first meditation retreat when I was 18, which really changed my life. So that confluence of just developing my own spiritual practice and way of looking at the world through a lens of not wanting to harm, in conjunction with developing an analysis of oppression and systemic change. But nobody in those movements in college wanted to talk about class or money. So I kind of just repressed that part of my background. And then when I was 22, my mom unexpectedly inherited money from her uncle, who through the GI Bill, which predominantly went to white veterans, was able to amass some money, which he invested in oil, tobacco, and war, as you do in the stock market, as you do. And through those investments in oil and tobacco and war, I inherited that money from him. And once that money was in my name, and I also graduated debt-free in college, which really put me in a different class position than my peers. Once that money was in my name and these corporations that I was organizing against, I knew I could no longer avoid dealing with money in class. And I had a reckoning with that. And at the same time, my beloved brother, John, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer unexpectedly. And he was only 25 at that time. And then he died shortly after when he was 26. And so the money came into my name. My brother, the unthinkable happened, which was my brother died. Unthinkable in part because he was my brother and we, you know, had a promise to live together forever. And also unthinkable because of the myths that wealth and academic success had created, that someone who had a Fulbright scholar, who had a 4.0 at Columbia University, was destined for great, you know, success and a long life. And that was a lie. And he died. Yeah. And that deeply, deeply politicized me around the lies that we had been taught about class and money. And the last thing I'll say is I then worked at Resource Generation for 5 years, a nonprofit that organizes young people with wealth to support the redistribution of land, wealth, and power. And then I left RG to become a money coach because I really wanted to do a deeper personal transformation space. I wanted to offer that type of space for people with wealth to redistribute, to divest, but to also rethink who we are as people and what roles we want to play in the world and disentangle the confusing mix of messages around money and belonging and self-worth and all these other things that come up around money in class. So that's why I'm here.
That's great. Really, And before we go further into money and class, although they're related, would you tell us a little bit about how you knew Ram Dass and what he meant to you, what you remember about him?
Absolutely. So I grew up next door to Ram Dass in Marin County. He was my brother's godfather. Mirabai is my godmother. So was really fortunate to have this web of spiritual teachers in my life as a child. And then after his stroke, when he then moved to Maui, my brother John, in between chemo treatments, would go and stay with him and as just a refuge to recover in. And after John died, I took his ashes all over the world. And one of the places I took them to was to Maui. And me and Dasima, Ram Dass's beyond caretaker. I don't know exactly what
the
role is. She's so much more than a caretaker. We planted his ashes and we planted this mango tree. And so then every year after his death, after John's death, I would go stay with Ram Dass and spend time with John's mango tree and spend time with Ram Dass and talk about death and mortality and illness and control and, you know, all of the wonderful things that if you're lucky, you get to talk to Ram Dass about. And our last visit, last time I saw Ram Dass, my favorite memory of his was just getting to join his weekly swim in the ocean where he and a bunch of people in his community will help carry him out into the sea and bring a bunch of flowers. And it's just basically seeing this like utter look of joy on his face as he gets to kind of surrender to the water with these beautiful flowers around him is just such a, it's an image I'll never forget.
Thank you. I just had that image again and him, him saying, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. Yeah. And then, oh joy, oh joy, oh joy.
He really
and
loved
I bet there are many other people having that image at this moment hearing you talk about it. Oh,
yeah.
God, yes. Well, let's start with this one. As you know, I just wrote a book with Ram Dass on dying, and we looked a lot about the American way of denial. Or it's not just American, but around denial, around death. And the pushing off of our fears around safety and death, and the many complicated things we do in order to not acknowledge that we are going to die, and that we don't know when we're going to die, and that the very pushing it away in all these ways we do it keeps us from doing the very thing we should be doing in order to be able to die well and to live well in the moment. So one of the statements of yours that I liked was, there's no amount of wealth that will guarantee you will live a long, comfortable life.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that a little bit? I mean, that could be like, oh yeah, of course, but we talk about the levels at which we really do believe that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, firsthand, of course, I learned that the hard way through witnessing my brother die. But I've also learned that from, you know, I sit in on a lot of financial planning meetings between clients and their planners. And the design of finance, the design of financial planning is to grasp for control over these things we cannot control, such as our mortality, illness, divorce, everything, right? But to try to, the mentality and the design is, if we can just set aside enough money for you, somehow you will live into old age. Somehow you will always be happy. Somehow your children will always love you and your children will be happy. And it's a lie and a myth that is sold as a part of financial planning. And it's also embedded in the investment industry, right? In wealth management firms, in investment firms who are saying to you, you know, if you invest your money, the stock market yields some of the highest returns, right? You make the most money in general from the stock market. It has its ups and downs, and it's incredibly volatile. But the myth that's being sold to you is if you invest in these extractive corporations and industries that are destroying the planet and the world, and you make that ethical compromise, you're going to have a lot more money later on and you'll be happier that you did it. So much for me when I think about finance is about avoiding mortality, is about fear and scarcity. And when we make decisions about anything from a fear and scarcity place, we're not going to make the most ethical decisions. So I see that a key obstacle that arises for clients who have social justice values, who believe in social justice movements and want to give away money, and they'll start giving, and then they'll hit this point where they're suddenly have this look of terror on their faces when I encourage them to increase, because I know that they can give away more money. And that look of terror can be about so many things. And often it's about facing mortality and facing the unknown, because this money has been a buffer for so many of us raised wealthy or who now have access to more money than we need. It's a buffer from having to deal with some of life's hardships, right? And so it summons an amount of courage and trust that we can increase our giving and still deal with life's hardships. So yeah, there's a lot there on that topic. And one other thing I'll say is that I do believe that investing in certain corporations that are causing death, right? Like when we invest in deforestation, fossil fuel companies that manufacture weaponry and prisons, we are invested in death. We are invested in destruction. And how is that really going to be worth it to us for the sake of a sense that we'll have more financial abundance in the future?
We could stop there and we'd have a lot to think about. Another statement that you made is definitions of enoughness vary dramatically across class, revealing how they are subjective and irrational. And I just want to, it made me think of so many things. And it's how my beginning understandings of what is enough and about how less is more were, you know, I lived on a commune for a while in British Columbia in the late 60s. And there, you know, we've been PhD students and, you know, we live in the city and we had everything we needed. And there we were, you know, cooking over open fires and washing our clothes in the stream and living in teepees and gathering wild berries, you know. And I left from there to go to India, and I'm not sure how long I would have survived there. But what it really showed me was like being like close to the land and close to, you know, the basic human needs. We could put up a structure, you know, and simply, and we could wash our clothes in the stream. And it made me feel more at home on the planet and made me realize I might want those other things, but, you know, I didn't need what I thought I needed. That was a big awakening. And then going on retreat, I think for a lot of us, you started out by talking about that. You know, what I love about being on, especially like meditation retreats, is you're in this room with a cot and maybe a chair, and there's a nearby bathroom, and you have everything you need and nothing else. And I loved that, you know? It's just without anybody saying anything, it's just a reminder that you're completely fine with just what you need and nothing else. So, one more thing was that this COVID time for a year and a half showed me I needed a lot less than I thought I needed.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't buy anything for a year and a half. It was great. And I didn't need to. And now I've changed a lot of my patterns, you know. So, yeah, so talk to us about enoughness and knowing how dramatically it that's held by different people and people within classes also. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think your story is so powerful about how settled and eased you felt having just the cot and the bathroom in a simple room. I do think it's stressful to have much more than we need. I think excess is stressful. And it's not to say, oh, woe is me. You know, I feel so bad for people with privilege, but I do think there is a stress that can come with having too much. And especially in a world in which most people don't have enough, it creates an inherent, I think, form of suffering, especially for those of us who have empathy, who have access to empathy, and who care deeply about being in solidarity with others. So, and yeah, I see wildly different assessments about what enoughness is, you know, because we live in this capitalist system in which you really can, there's just such a huge variety of what people earn, of what people have access to, and of how much money people spend. And there aren't really any rules out there. We're kind of just, if you have the money, you can go wild with your spending with really no consequences. It's just kind of a strange economic system that we're in. And so I have had a client who spends, I've had clients who spend a range of, you know, $20,000 a year to $350,000 a year. That's a profound range with no consequences and no real, nothing to bump up, but nobody telling you to narrow in your spending, right? I have client, you know, I know people in the world who do not have wealthy backgrounds who believe that if they had $50,000, they would feel like the richest person in the world. And then I have clients who have, you know, $20 million, but are afraid to give away $1 million. So I think that, and then as I, you know, the article that Mirabai's referencing is the article that I published recently about the vicious cycle of wealth accumulation and the five pillars of true safety and security beyond money. And in that cycle, I talk about how it creates this feedback loop. If I grow up as I did, accustomed to immense material comforts and privilege, anything less than that is going to feel uncomfortable to me because I've been trained into expecting a degree of comfort. If I grow up, and that then informs my sense of enoughness and what feels safe and what feels okay to give away, but it doesn't really have any bearing with reality. As you said, what do we need to survive? We need food. We need shelter. We need a cot to lie down on. We need community. We need meaning and belonging too, I would add. We need medicine. We need access to healthcare. The things beyond that are all questionable and up in the air. And there's also a wild variety of how we can address those needs with different price tags too. So there is no clear, you know, one and done answer about enoughness. But I think that it's each of our responsibility, especially for those of us in the US and especially for those of us who have access to even a little bit more money than we might need to really critically examine these questions for ourselves.
Yeah, I like that somewhere you quoted around this Abby Disney saying, you know, if you go from coach to business to first class, you're never going to want to go back to coach. You should get used to it, you know, and then it feels like a hardship. But so being, I think in terms of waking up, practice really helps you see your own mind, you know, and it helps you see that, oh my God, I think I have to have first class. What am I thinking? You know?
And one other thing I'll say about this, just, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the second precept and about not stealing. And of course, you know, our mind goes to obvious places about what that means. Like, yeah, I won't go into a store and shoplift. I won't, you know, steal cash from your drawer, whatever. But what does it mean to exist in a world with a finite amount of resources and with massive inequities? And to keep more money than you truly need, right? I think there's an argument to be made that it is a form of theft to keep money, keep more money than we need because we're afraid, to inherit money that we did nothing to earn, and to not consider redistribution and to not consider reparations. So I think that if we apply that, you know, just thinking about that precept and with money, right? How do we really honor all of the precepts and how we think about money? And in particular, this question of theft and where does your money come from to begin with, right? You can't just, it doesn't just come from nowhere. It doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from the labor of others. It comes from other people creating that money that you then got into your hands through whatever ways that you did. And for me, like I said, the money that I inherited, you know, was stolen from so many different communities. And so I do think there's kind of an ethical question that we get to explore about how to honor these precepts through looking at our finances.
Yeah. Oh, I really like that. I mean, just seeing it as this opportunity to wake up, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. How great. Instead of a burden that we carry, which also that, but you know.
And there's joy in moving money.
Oh,
there's
big joy.
Joy and liberation in finally like dealing with this thing you've been avoiding and then looking at where your money is invested and feeling joy and delight and knowing it's building a future that you would be thrilled to participate in giving away money and funding movements that are fighting so hard to improve the lives of millions of people, giving gifts to your friends, right? It feels good. I know it's cheesy, mm-hmm. but it feels not only good, yeah. but it feels there's a, you know, like in the article, the self-trust, it builds self-trust, that empowerment sense that you are leading a values aligned life is there's no amount of money that is worth more than that feeling. So.
Yeah. I'm glad you know that and said that. You know, for years, excuse me, for the 10 years I worked in Guatemala with Seva, and then all these years at the Center for Contemplative Mind, I've always been raising money, right? And often people would say, I hate to fundraise. I don't want to do that, you know? And it's hard, not many people do. It's very hard to find anybody who loves it and understands it and is good at it. And So I was kind of forced to figure out why it was I really liked doing it, you know. And I can remember those moments, you know, of real joy because whatever I was raising it for, I mean, I'd come out of these Guatemalan villages where they had absolutely nothing and know that just such a small amount of money from the north could really help. And it would be a struggle to do it because people up here didn't really know what was going on down there and really care about it. And then when I'd be able to do that, to shift the money from here to there, it was really joyful. And and it really had to do with, you know, aligning the person with the wealth, aligning their values with the values that I was working with in trying to make change in other places that didn't have money. And so exploring all that together, I got great happiness out of that role. Yeah. So thank you for that. So you were leading into, and that does too, but or coming up against the importance of community. And I'm focusing on individual safety and survival creates less safety for everyone. And I'll just tell you one thing before, it just came to mind when we were working in Guatemala and we first went there, we were welcomed into this village and they told us their whole story. And, you know, they were in devastating conditions. And so we were, this was Johanna and me, and I forget who else was there that day. And we were so moved by it, and we really wanted to do something. And we thought, we'll go home and we'll raise some money. So, and we tried to talk to them about what they would do first and what it would cost and all of that. And we decided somehow that, unbelievably, that $40,000 would be able to help support this village for 1 year, for everybody in the village for 1 year. And they could get going rebuilding their houses and their land and so on. So we said that, and we said that we would go home and try to raise that. And they said, and we thought they'd be like so happy. You know, they said, well, we couldn't just take it for our village because they were in this connection. I forget what it was called, but some collaboration among 9 villages. And they said, if you give us that money, these are Mayan people who understood. They didn't have a concept of themselves as individuals separate from community. And they said, but if you give us that money, we will share it with all 9 villages. And we were thinking, well, then nobody would have really enough to do anything. And we don't think that's a good idea, kind of, you know, until we like got it. We said, yeah. Oh my God. Oh, that's really amazing. And so, of course, what we did was we came home and we raised 40 times 9.
Awesome.
So they taught me so much about community and how the strength of that. They had nothing, but they had community. And they rebuilt their lives and their homes. And
they didn't have nothing. Having community is pretty valuable.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, talk a little about the relationship of the individual and the community and resources and safety.
Yeah. Well, again, in part, this article came in response to seeing some of the shortcomings of financial planning and short kind of limitations in imagination that I see and that I personally have struggled with around thinking about safety and security in a financial context. And it's just interesting the default messages that we're taught, again, especially people in the United States, even more so for those of us who are white and also for those of us who are wealthy. The fantasy that we're painted is for you and your nuclear family to own a home, just you all, right? To save enough money for just you all to retire. And those are the key financial goals that most people have. But it's just, I want to question and rethink that default norm because like in the example that you shared, right? Why can't we cast a bigger net around who we care about and who we want to incorporate into our financial planning, right? Even if we just go one layer out around, okay, I want to make sure that my cousins and my, broader family is going to be taken care of and nourished and supported in their older age, or that we understand we have a shared safety net should anyone experience a health crisis or something like that. But why not continue to even expand that beyond just the blood family? And to also incorporate communities, something that I like to suggest to people is to at minimum match your retirement contributions with a contribution to a climate justice organization, right? So that we can have a planet that we'll be able to retire on. Bring your friends into your retirement planning, right? Especially your friends who don't have the same level of access to wealth and material safety that you might have. And when we do that, and when we broaden our sense of who we care about, we're feeding into this web of interconnection that will also then take care of us inherently, right? And I find it to be more scary and isolating and also just kind of empty feeling to just think about myself, to just think about like, who am I, Iris, on a little island? What do I need when I'm 65? What do I need when I'm 75? What do I need next year? What do I need tomorrow? That it builds into this narrative of isolation from other people. And especially in a world that's as volatile and scary as it is today, at least I think my generation is deeply feeling like the promises of the future that other generations were given probably won't come to us because of the climate crisis and because of living in late stage capitalism. I think a lot of us are facing, and most of us don't have enough money to retire. Most of us do not have these safety nets. Most of us have horrendous debt. So as a generation of people who are mostly in debt, where the future is so unknown, I really want us to move towards supporting one another and saying, hey, you know, right now this person has more money than they need. It can flow into the community and vice versa. And I don't mean to be utopian and, you know, like I understand there's things we need to take into account and be thoughtful about with money. And also in creating these contracts, it's not all easy. It's quite hard actually to talk to other people about money in class, especially if you're not accustomed to it. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a beautiful opportunity of just bringing other people into our sense of well-being. Like you wouldn't just think about your emotional well-being separate from your friends and from your community. And from, that's so why great. Would we think about our financial well-being as separate from our friends and our community?
Well, we're talking about friends and family and expanding. I guess you're saying this. I've been thinking about the idea of personal reparations. Now, this is expanding into for white Americans into the African American community, but just giving away money to individuals. Not, I mean, we know, those of us who know, know that it's good to support organizations in that realm that are led by Black leadership and that are, you know, shifting resources in many different ways. But you touched on it with saying just like, you know, make sure your cousin has enough money, or just giving money to your friends, or, you know, who don't have as much. I only thought about this in the last couple of years and started doing it. So,
yes.
Do you have thoughts about that?
I do. I'm so glad you're bringing this up. There's so much beautiful work happening in the world of reparations, both to support Black-led organizations and also Indigenous-led organizations. I really want to lift up the work of Edgar Villanueva, who formed Liberated Capital, which is a new reparations fund that redistributes money to different movements across the United States that are led by Black and Brown individuals with a focus on reparations. And there's also a huge, beautiful donor community that folks can get involved in who want to learn about reparations, who want to learn about unpacking white supremacy. They're just, I can't endorse them enough. And I really recommend everyone listening right now, consider giving a gift to them and getting involved. I think there's a lot of different ways to approach reparations. The first being to look back at our own story. Where did your money come from and which communities was it extracted from? Even if you don't have access to wealth, right? If you are a white person or if you aren't Black or Indigenous to this land, what are ways in which your family has socially benefited from anti-Black racism, right? Or even just living on this land, which was stolen from Indigenous communities. We're all part of this really dark and violent history, regardless of our personal dignity and values. We're just kind of born into this history. So we all have work to do there around looking at that history. If we link it to money, I encourage folks to give money back to the communities it was extracted from, to incorporate that reparations framework into your giving. Better yet, why not communicate that story to the people, to the organizations you're giving to? Not to paint yourself as the hero, but of just to name. Part of reparations is naming the harm that happened and noting the actions that you're taking to address that harm. And I have one client whose money comes from more directly from, she's a descendant of slave owners. And in working with her, was able to support her to move millions of dollars into Black-led organizing and reparations work in the South, and in particular in the state where her ancestors owned slaves.
That's so good.
And in addition to that, in addition to the beautiful process of her getting to move this money, also got to work together on how to communicate transparently and directly with these groups of saying, my money came from the theft mm-hmm. of wealth from your ancestors. And I am here to own that legacy. And I'm here to offer healing to my legacy by telling you the truth. This about this dark history of my people and how I am linked to you and how I'm indebted to you. And that is why I'm giving you this money. And to add in that story, because part of reparations, part of repair is around naming and acknowledging the harm that was caused in addition to taking action to address it. So we don't just talk about it. We also do things. So I really encourage folks, as much as you can discover these things about your story and your lineage, to also speak those stories and to normalize addressing reparations. We don't need to then get mired in guilt and shame, especially when it comes to our ancestors. We didn't choose the actions that they chose, but we get to take responsibility for them and we get to move forward with a commitment to prevent future harm from happening and to address harm that was caused in the past. So give to Liberated Capital, give to other reparations focused organizations. It's not just about giving to individuals. It's also about giving to groups that are fighting for reparations on policy levels and fighting to make different policies that will improve the lives of Black and Brown communities in this country too. So
that's great. And you'll include some links, for the people can follow after.
Absolutely.
This.
I'll send you some resources.
That'd be great.
Absolutely.
That'd be great. Because yes. I do think it's an area where people are not quite sure where to go or what to do, although they may have good intentions.
I got you. I will help make it easy for you.
Okay, great. Let's see. You also talked about how wealth accumulation can keep you from cultivating inner resilience. That if we have lots of financial resources, we often tend to lean on those, to use those instead of cultivating our capacities for being in community, for developing skills we can offer to others, and for deep Dharma skills that we can use for helping ourselves feel safe in as much as anything is safe. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. You know, and it's so similar to the story you shared about when we're on retreat and we're living a slightly more austere life, the ways in which, first of all, we get to feel that sense of ease of simplicity, but also things get really uncomfortable, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I sat on a 30-day retreat.
Oh, you did.
I sat on a 30-day retreat once. It was very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very hard and uncomfortable. But I left with so much more inner resilience and strength as a result of being with all the uncomfortable things. I think I had a poison oak at one point, plus just the troubles of my mind that I had to be with for weeks on end. But I left with this inner sanctuary, right? The sense of like, you know, I got through that. I live to tell the tale, and I now know how to face those incredibly uncomfortable, emotional, and physically challenging experiences without paying for a way to get out or without distracting myself from it. So when we're denied those opportunities to face hardships head on and to have to tap into our inner resilience and resourcefulness, like what Abigail Disney said, right? She doesn't have to deal with the long lines at the airport and her flight getting canceled and all, you know, deal with COVID exposure by flying private. Her artery, that's more, she mentioned flying private beyond just first class. So you lose your sense of resilience when you are constantly comfortable. I don't think it's good for us to be constantly comfortable physically, materially, emotionally, because then we are not growing. And so I think, you know, as someone who was raised with wealth, I always had a way out. I always had a way out. If I was doing poorly in a class, I could just pay for a tutor, pay for someone to come in and save the day, rather than face some of my inadequacies or my struggles around a particular topic. You know, if I miss a flight, I'll just keep talking about airports for whatever reason, even though I haven't flown for a year and a half. Yeah. If I miss a flight, no big deal. I'll just buy another ticket. There's no consequences. So therefore, I don't need to change or adjust my behavior. I don't need to develop skills and resourcefulness. And I think this is one of the ways that wealth accumulation, it actually causes us harm. And it inhibits our ability to unleash our power and our connection with ourselves and others, because it's like we're living in a room filled with pillows. You know, we're just kind of have all of these pillows around us, which at first might feel comfortable, but then you kind of are like, dang, I don't want to just be like, my back kind of hurts from lying on these pillows are too soft. You know, I got to kind of get out into the world and be with people and deal with things. So that's kind of how I see it.
Well, I know you're right. And it's interesting because hardly anybody ever talks about the shadow side of money. It's always positive. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a time when I was looking at the people I kind of cared about the most and liked being with. And I realized that I was drawn to people who had suffered because they had those kinds of skills, appreciations, orientation toward life that was just expansive. And I wanted to be around that. I felt safer around people who've gone through suffering because they have cultivated those aspects that you're talking about. I mean, I think that's...
And they often have a really good sense of humor.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, because that's a skill for survival.
Like Ram Dass did.
Yes. Ram Dass was so amazing because he had it all, and then he knew about having nothing. And in fact, he was really great at raising money and giving it away. And as soon as he would raise it, he'd give it away. So that when he had a stroke, he was completely broke. He had no money at all, and he had lots of resources in the sense of who he was, but he didn't have a home. He didn't have a car, I don't think. He didn't have anything. What he had were all of us who loved him and were going to make sure that he got taken care of. But
Exactly.
So he's like a perfect exemplar for what you're saying. Yeah, interesting. What else do you want to say? We had a few minutes
more
left,
reliable but... than the stock market, you know?
Yes, yes. I think that's so important to say. So that's not to say that we shouldn't all have enough so that, well, for one thing, we don't, as we age, do you know anybody who's aging? Yeah. So as we get old, and I won't go into my whole story, but what I know is it's not good to not have anything, because then even if you have wonderful friends and community, you don't really want them to have to take total care of you for your last X number of years. So it is good, of course, to have a little stash to take care of yourself as you go forward. But just to return to, you know, we're talking about excess and how we don't, we don't always see it as excess. So question, you know, keep questioning. What else?
I appreciate you mentioning this, Mirabai, because, you know, I am so used to just speaking to a wealthy audience, but I really want to echo what you said. We do need to learn about how money works. We do need to be thoughtful about our finances and plan for the future. And so I don't mean to diminish that importance.
Yeah, I know.
Around taking ourselves into consideration too, around enoughness and around becoming financially literate. So I really appreciate you bringing that up. And I guess the last things that I just wanted to say, if that's okay.
Can
you
yes.
still hear me? So in addition to just some call to actions, things to consider in leaving this session, this conversation. One is I really want to encourage any Dharma teachers, any spiritual leaders to consider talking about money in your communities, to consider bringing this into your curriculum and the practice, because most of us struggle to think well about money. We need guidance. Probably a lot of the teachers in meditation and spiritual communities also need help and support around that. So we'll show the areas you need to grow, but to find ways of talking about money in your community. And there's so many people with access to wealth in different spiritual communities too, who I know could use a hand in moving money. And the more we just normalize talking about money, talking about wealth inequalities and classism and reparations, right? I think it's such an essential part of spiritual growth and spiritual healing. And for those of you who are practitioners on the call and students, for you to, you know, look at your finances with the same level of care and thoughtfulness that you look at the words that you use, you know, when you're talking to people, right? And you look at the other, you know, we scrutinize our behavior as spiritual people, hopefully through lines of ethics. And we should do that too with money. And also volunteer our time and our skills, right? It's not just about money, but it's just about it's time and showing up for the future that we want to be building. And so I think those are my main call to actions. And I would love to go on a meditation retreat and have people talk about money and have people talk about giving in more specificity and have people talk about all these other things, retirement, all the things you're naming. I would love that.
That's great. Well, maybe you will lead it. We'll see. Iris, I loved this conversation. I loved it. And I really appreciate you talking to us and also all the work you've done. And I know you're just beginning. I can hear from the way you express your thoughts that they're open-ended and you're going to keep investigating. So thank you. Thank you so much. And there'll be...
thank you so much, Mirabai.
And for all of you that on the page, on the website, you will find Iris's bio and contact information and links to the various organizations that she talked about. So thanks for listening. Bye. Thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.